Grade 1 Conference, Lecture 12, The Four Temperaments, Part 8. We're going to look at the choleric again. I've said that this is the temperament that comes to us in the most homeopathic dose, in part because it would be very hard to work with a whole lot of cholerics at once. And just to give you an idea of the qualities that the cholerics carry, I'd like you for a moment to think of the U.S. armed forces, and of course other nations have similar divisions. In the U.S. they're very marked. We have four major divisions. We've got the Army, we've got the Navy, we've got the Air Force, we've got the Marines, and they recruit differently, they draw people with different qualities. And let's think about them for a moment. We could say that the Army is sort of like the melancholic branch of the armed forces. Now, for a long, long time, in the 20th century, you were drafted into the Army. There are certainly people who are recruited, but a great many had to go there whether they wished to or not. That was the basic fighting force in America. And you're marching a lot, you're carrying a heavy load, and you often have to spend long periods of time in trenches, which are very uncomfortable places to be, and you're kind of a target. You're the first big group that goes into battle, and not always with the greatest protection. There's a whole lot of stuff in the Army that veterans will tell you that's not easy, is not terribly glorious, but is just kind of day by day getting through it and waiting and waiting until the moment comes when you really have to face death in a very square and very immediate way. Kind of different from the Navy. In the Navy, you're on a ship, and one thing that's very likely is that in the course of your time on that ship, you're not going to run out of food. You're probably not going to be eating K-rations. You're going to be able to eat in a hall of some kind or other, and the food will be probably prepared for you, because the ship functions like an independent little city, or even like an independent little nation, and it provides a great deal for you. It's very possible that the whole time that you're on your ship, you're never exposed to direct fire, that you are sending planes off from your ship to go to distant targets, they're coming back, or you're shooting very powerful guns at the land, and there aren't guns as powerful to respond to you from the other side. So there's more of a degree of safety, assuming that the ship doesn't get hit, in which case you're at least still have possibility of lifeboats. You're eating, you're changing from darker colors in the winter to whiter colors in the summer. You're swabbing the deck, you're keeping that ship clean and in ship shape. So it's a much more easygoing existence than the Army, and in that respect we could say it has a very phlegmatic quality to it. The Air Force, well, you know, you've got these beautiful, sleek jet planes, which will sort of serve as the template for the design of the next generation of luxury cars when you get back home. You're allowed to paint images on your plane if you shoot other planes down. Everything is from a very great distance. You may be dropping bombs on people who are miles below you. You may be fighting a dogfight thousands of feet up in the air. At least these were the classic pictures of the Air Force. It's changed a bit. And you're allowed to modify your uniform and make it look really cool. leather jackets, white scarves. These things have become the fashion setters for future generations, and you're in the air. You're in the wild blue yonder. So there the astral body is strongly at work, and we have the sanguine part of the armed forces. But all we need, as they say, are a few good men, and that's the Marines. The Marines are the smallest branch of the armed forces with the most rigorous and demanding training programs. And they are the ones who are taught to be the first at the scene of the battle. The Marines are always sent in to hit hard, work with tremendous immediacy, what Donald Rumsfeld called shock and awe. And they're trained still to fight with their bayonets first and only use their rifles later when they must. So the Marines embody the choleric part of the armed forces. When I was growing up in a fairly tough neighborhood in New York City, you'd say to somebody, "Do you want to fight?" "Yeah." "Well, join the Marines." And there is some truth to that. In fact, it's very interesting if we look at the history of the 20th and early 21st century presidential politics. Most of our American presidents who have been in the armed forces have either been in the Navy or had a strong connection to the Navy. So the president comes from the more phlegmatic branch of the armed forces. Eisenhower, very popular, was an exception to that, an army man. And yet, when he wants to get things done, when he needs to have a really tough, albeit not always visible presence around him, then he calls on a Marine. Most of the chiefs of staff of most American presidents have indeed been Marines. They have not come from the Navy like the presidents. So the chief of staff, the figure who is not technically in charge, is not the one who's elected, but rather is the one who really holds the power. That's very often the position that the choleric likes to be in. So when we meet the choleric child, we want them to be able to see us as someone stronger than they, someone who is more of an authority than they are. In the final analysis, the choleric always wants to be number two, a strong number two, recognized as an important figure, but wants to serve someone who is stronger than he or she. So this is the challenge of working with the choleric child. You want to let them know that you're stronger. You want to let them know that in the end, your word holds and not theirs. But you also want to give them the space in which they can unfold the spiritual capacities which cholerics bring in many ways in such abundance into human life and even right down into their childhood. So keeping this healthy balance between letting the child kind of be out there and try things and be bold and perhaps even reckless now and then, and yet also letting that child always know that there's someone behind them, someone above them, who is going to keep an eye on them. This means that now and then, you're going to have to raise your voice when you speak to a choleric, when he's just hit somebody and sees, you know, nothing wrong with having done that. You're going to want to show the choleric that you too can carry anger, that you too can carry a stentorian force in your voice, but then right away, leave the anger and do something that evokes laughter, or leave the loud voice and speak in just a normal tone of voice. Let the choleric child see that you are in charge of those powerful fire forces that live within you. And as I said, you know, walking around like a choleric, trying to see the world as the choleric would see it, this can help you when these critical moments come. I always found it best, when a choleric got in trouble, to pull that child away from the scene of the trouble. So let's say there's a fight going on outside. It's very possible that the choleric struck the first blow and it got worse after that. He is fighting with a sanguine child, and the sanguine child is screaming to high heaven. Talk to the sanguine child first, you know, perhaps even let them stay outside or just have them go in the classroom. But you can talk to the sanguine child right at the scene of the crime. For the choleric child, you've got to take him away. Because as I've said, that warmth body, that nascent ego of the choleric child is very much on the outside. It is very, very sensitive to everything in the immediate environment. And it's not to say that the trees in the schoolyard evoked this fight, but they're not going to help heal it because that's where the fight happened. So back into the classroom you go, or maybe just into the hall, but away from wherever the fight or any other altercation or problem occurred, and talk to the choleric for a little while. And it just may be, you know, in no uncertain terms, you are not to hit people. We'll find out what happened tomorrow. But no matter what happened, there is no excuse for hitting him. Now, I want you to go up and shake his hand, apologize. You know, just a few commands like that, imperative voice, strong, if not necessarily, you know, angry, but just clear and strong. And then the next day, approximately 24 hours later, talk to the choleric again about what happened and go over it step by step. You may want the other child there as well. But at least the choleric needs about 24 hours to settle down, because that anger can just kind of rise up, and then he feels remorseful about what he did and is sort of tormented by it, and back and forth we go, and that's not going to be, you know, really conducive to solving the problem and to settling what the choleric needs. So that's one technique that I certainly urge you to work with. And here again, cholerics also can respond to stories in which they see a lot of action, a lot of dynamic, and perhaps something that goes too far and has to find its correction or the wall against which it must crash. And this is really, that wall is sometimes going to be you. And this is great, but the other thing you have to watch out for is, because cholerics like to bond with one person who they feel is really their leader, you do not want to be competing with their parents. You want to help their parents, who very often are at their wits' end with a choleric child, you know, feeling like good modern people, they should never holler at their child or discipline them too firmly. But what else can you do? So you don't want them to feel that you're the only one who can handle him. You know, don't build up your ego too much in this regard. And you also are going to, little by little, help that child develop respect for the specialist teachers. And I haven't talked about the specialist teachers very much yet, but this is another part of our work, helping the specialist teachers understand the temperaments of our children and helping the children to feel the same degree of respect and regard for those specialists that they do for us. And the choleric is a very good place to start with this. And we'll see later on, you know, what other steps we can take to help the choleric find something civilized in his being.